Chief Justice Roberts, thank you so much for those remarks. They were very insightful and informative. And again, welcome to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Now, we do believe that one of the most important things that we do as a technological research university is to serve as a crossroads for brilliant and focused people across generations. That's what universities inherently are, across disciplines, sectors, and geographies, who work together to address hard problems and to offer new perspectives to our students who will be the leaders of the future. And so that's why we're very happy today to hear your insights. Now, before becoming the Chief Justice of the United States in 2005, you had a very distinguished career. You worked in the White House, in the U.S. Department of Justice, and on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Now, as former Vice Chair of the Board of Regents for 3 years and a member of the Executive Committee, I had the great pleasure of working with you, as you pointed out, at the Smithsonian Institution. And one of my big privileges has been to meet quarterly with the Chief Justice in that role. And so this is one of the many responsibilities that accrue to you in the role of Chief Justice of the United States. And I will ask you something about that in a little while. But let me take up from where you left off. You are a great student of history in general, and obviously the history of the United States Supreme Court. And so you went through and you talked about a number of your predecessors, all of them, in fact. But which historical figure or which historical justice would you say has influenced you the most in terms of either legal thinking or just in terms of comportment as the Chief Justice?
I think that's an easy question to answer, and I think most, certainly the majority of justices on the court and throughout history would give the same answer. John Marshall is the model for a Supreme Court justice. He was the first person to take the job seriously. If you remember, Jay was off being a diplomat. Rutledge was there for 6 months. Ellsworth was doing other things. Marshall took it seriously, and he appreciated the role of the court in sort of bringing the United States together under the Constitution, under the rule of law. And he had a very particular focus. He's the author of some great decisions that define our nation, but he also had a very modest and measured understanding of his job. Marbury versus Madison was a huge controversy. It was the battle between the Jeffersonian Republicans and the Federalists. Jefferson had won the presidency. His party had won the House. They had won the Senate. There was one place where they weren't dominant, and that was in the new judiciary. And they had a bullseye right on John Marshall's back. Jefferson and Marshall were actually cousins, and they hated each other. And this was his opportunity, Jefferson's, to get the Federalists out. No one knew exactly what they were going to do with the judiciary. Remember, the Constitution is still very new. And this case came up. And the question is, would Marshall rule in favor of the Federalists in creating these midnight judges, and therefore rule in favor of his party and give the Jeffersonians an excuse to attack the courts? Or would he rule in favor of the Republicans and not allow the new Federalist judges to take office, which would have been a question viewed as surrender and would allow them to take further steps? So what Marshall did is it was a very restrained approach. He concluded that the Federalist judges could not take office. But they couldn't take office because the law that would allow them to was unconstitutional. So he was telling the public that the court did not have the power to do something. So the Federalist judges were not able to take office. They didn't have the power to appoint them. So yes, it was a defeat. The Jeffersonian Republicans blocked the Federalists from becoming judges, but Marshall established the principle that the court could declare the laws of Congress unconstitutional, a tremendous victory for the Federalists. So he was very restrained. He had a way of diffusing political controversy and focusing on a case. And I think that's something that justices and judges should keep in mind when they decide cases.
Now that's interesting because it plays into actually my next question. And you often have pointed out that the United States Supreme Court is not a political branch of the government and that its decisions are not to steer policy but are made on the legal merits of the cases. I think you made those points very beautifully in the classes you visited today. But the Supreme Court, we have to admit, currently does operate in a highly political environment, one that some people feel came about more recently because of the refusal of the U.S. Senate to consider Judge Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court seat that opened up when we lost Justice Antonin Scalia. And now, after an extremely partisan, some might say, confirmation process, President Trump's nominee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, was sworn in yesterday. So how does the confirmation process for today's Supreme Court nominees in this political environment differ from the past? But is it really different, so different from the past?
Well, first I want to point out one thing, that throughout this whole process, the Supreme Court has been quietly going about its business of deciding the cases before it according to the Constitution in a completely nonpartisan way. We've done it for the past 14 months with one vacancy, and we'll do it going into the future now that we have a full complement. It is a real danger that the partisan hostility that people see in the political branches will infect the nonpartisan activity of the judicial branch. It is very difficult, I think, for a member of the public to look at what goes on in confirmation hearings these days, which is a very sharp conflict in political terms, in Democrats and Republicans, and not think that the person who comes out of that process must similarly share that same sort of partisan view of public issues and public life. That's very unfortunate because we in the judiciary do not do our business in a partisan, ideological manner. The new justice is not a Republican and not a Democrat. He's a member of the Supreme Court. But it's hard for people to understand that when they see the process that leads up to it. The process, I think, has been very partisan at times in the past, but certainly not to the extent it is now. And the debate, or the nature of these partisan hearings has a very unsavory background. I think Justice Brandeis was the very first justice who was subjected to a hearing, clearly because of anti-Semitic prejudice against his appointment. For a long time, there weren't hearings at all. For a long time, people were just confirmed by acclamation. As recently, in recent times, Justice Scalia was approved, I think it was by a unanimous vote. So that partisanship is a matter of great concern, both because it might affect public perception and because that would thereby undermine the appreciation of the public of the nonpartisan way in which we do our business.
Could you tell our students a bit more about how cases actually come to be heard before the Supreme Court and how among the many thousands of petitions it receives each year, the court decides which cases to review?
It's actually pretty straightforward. We get about 8,500 cases a year. They're called petitions for certiorari, which is just an old historic French term to describe an effort to get in the door. And we only hear 75 of them. It does no good in your petition to say this is a great travesty of justice, I shouldn't have won. By then you've had at least two levels of judicial review, often three, and we're not what they call a court of error. Our business is not correcting mistakes. We look for problems of uniformity. If you have a federal court of appeals in California that says you can deduct this expense on your taxes, and one in New York, same question, and it says you can't, there's got to be one answer, and we're the people who provide it. So we'll take that tax case. That's why actually most of the cases that we resolve are not terribly interesting and of not terribly controversial and affect fairly limited areas, because we're resolving disuniformity, not saying we're only taking the important cases. There are other cases we'll take. If it's an opinion declaring a law of Congress unconstitutional, we'll take that. We think that before we strike down a law of Congress, we ought to have the final say, not a lower court. And the same with decisions severely restricting activities of the president. But mostly it's looking for cases that are coming out in opposite ways that should come out the same.
Now, as you know, we do science and engineering primarily here, not exclusively. And our alumni and our faculty and students are rapidly advancing artificial intelligence, cognitive and supercomputing and other smart technologies. You know, I thought about this when one young person asked the question about the cost of taking a case all the way through the judicial system up to and including the Supreme Court. Can you foresee a day when smart machines, driven with artificial intelligences, will assist with courtroom fact-finding or, more controversially, even judicial decision-making?
Well, it's a day that's here, and it's putting a significant strain on how the judiciary goes about doing things. It's not necessarily has to be the most sophisticated technology, but just videotaping. I mean, with smartphones, everything's on tape now. I say tape, everything's recorded. And that makes a difference. The structure in the federal judiciary, for example, is your trial court. The judge who's there in the courtroom examining the witnesses makes the factual determinations. There's testimony, okay, you saw the car go this way, what did you see? The judge says, I don't think you're telling the truth, you know, and he makes his decision. And then we defer to that at a higher level. We don't hear more witnesses. We say, well, the judge saw the witnesses, the judge decided this. Well, now there's a video of it. And if the question is, well, did the car swerve this way or not, why would we defer to the trial judge? We look at it ourselves. That's a tremendous revolution in how the structure is set up. DNA evidence. Everyone thinks DNA evidence exonerates people, and it does, and that's very important. It convicts far more many more people than it exonerates. I wasn't there, officer. This is what happened. I wasn't there. Well, here's the DNA. And it does change the whole nature of the process. Even for collection, we had a case the other day, you're arrested, can they take a DNA sample from you as a means of identification? This is who you are. Well, of course, what they do then, they immediately take it, run it through the databases and say, you're the guy that's wanted for this murder. Does that violate the Fourth Amendment? The impact of technology has been across the board, and we haven't yet really absorbed how it's going to change the way we do business.
It's interesting. You know, in 2012, we had the privilege of hosting Justice Antonin Scalia at our commencement, and at the President's commencement colloquy, where I have a discussion with our honorary degree recipients, I asked him about his dissenting opinion, and this isn't about the case, it's about the thinking, about his dissenting opinion in Massachusetts versus the EPA, which held then that the EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And he replied memorably, I think, I don't do science, I do law, right? But, you know, as you've pointed out, there's no question that science and technology are transforming our national life in terms of our understanding of the commons, of free speech, national security, and as you pointed out, even questions about privacy, including personal information that is encoded in our DNA. But the Constitution was written in 1787, which was just 35 years after Benjamin Franklin used a kite and a key to prove that lightning was a form of electricity. So given this pace of change, you know, how can we apply the Constitution in today's frame? And you know, you've sort of started talking about how it really affects the Supreme Court's decision-making, not just as a tool, but in terms of how you rationalize the Constitution of 1787 to today.
Well, in many areas, the framers had great foresight. There were things that bothered them about what the British had done, and they were setting up a new government with new rights in response to that. And some of the provisions they put in were very particular, but some were not. Some were broader. Take an example. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. That is a principle that you can carry forward no matter what the technological development is. We had the case just a couple of years ago. The rules were well established that when you arrest somebody, you can search anything on their body. And the reasons are pretty clear. You want to make sure they don't have a gun, they have a knife or whatever. So everything there you can search, including things in a container. You can open it up, make sure everything's fine. Well, we had the case a few years ago. The police arrest someone. He's got a cell phone, a smartphone. And, you know, they go through it and find all sorts of incriminating information in it. The claim was, did they need a search warrant for that? Did the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures protect against that? Well, it seemed at the surface the answer was obviously no. We have all these cases say whatever you find, you can search. But we looked at it a little differently and decided that the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures was put in because of their experience with British officers kicking down the door, rummaging through your desk drawers and finding information. So who here, if you had the choice, would rather protect what is in your desk drawers at home or rather protect what's on your smartphone? So much more is on the smartphone that implicates personal privacy. Who you know, who you talk to, what you said, where you've been, what sort of things you'd like to look at, everything. And so we decided that, no, the Fourth Amendment protection does extend to the contents of those cell phones, despite all the cases saying when you arrest somebody, you can get look at whatever's on them. Now, that's 1789, the Fourth Amendment protection applied to today's technology. I don't think anyone would have imagined the cell phone back then, maybe Jefferson. That principle still applies.
Well, I can't ask you how something may be looked at on a prospective basis, but you know, I think as we work to try to protect ourselves vis-a-vis terrorism and so on, there are questions that come up having to do with people being asked to give up the contents or give up their cell phones and open them up to even come into the country, even if they're citizens. So I think it's going to be interesting. But let me get to controversial question 105 here. You know, at the opening of the new National Museum of African American History and Culture last fall, you know, in your capacity as chancellor, you gave what I thought was a wonderful speech, considering the journey of the Supreme Court toward equal justice under the law. And in fact, you spoke about the Brown v. Board of Education decision, which, as you know, was extremely significant in my life because I ended up being able to travel to good public schools right in my own neighborhood instead of traveling miles across the city to a segregated school. Now, in recent years, the Supreme Court has reviewed a number of cases involving race, including challenges to the Voting Rights Act and the use of race in jury selection, or obviously in school composition. Now, we've come a long way on the road to equal justice, yet we both would admit there are tensions around those issues today, and one could argue always have been. So how do strict interpretations of a constitution, written in a time when certain groups were left out of the constitutional framework, allow fair and reasonable decisions? And, you know, does it link to some of what you said about technology, or is there some other point of reference?
Well, I think I would first get the vocabulary settled just a little bit.
Good.
The old use of the term strict construction or loose construction, I think, is very misleading. Hugo Black, Justice, probably the most aggressive defender of First Amendment freedoms in our history, said he was a strict constructionist. Mm-hmm. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. No law means no law. It's all protected by the First Amendment. So those aren't really terms that I think are particularly meaningful. But it's the same principle, right? After the Civil War amendments, we're not just talking about 1787 now, we're talking about the Civil War and the consequences of that and the amendments passed in the wake of that, abolishing slavery and guaranteeing equal protection. Those embody certain principles, protect equal protection of laws, that, like the Fourth Amendment protection of, against unreasonable searches and seizures, carry forward into situations that were not envisioned by the drafters of those amendments or the framers. Again, the drafters of the amendments after the Civil War also had a particular vision of what they were looking to, equal protection, and that has to be applied to the particular situations. Now, it's not just like in the case of the Fourth Amendment. It's not self-evident what the right answer is. Mm-hmm. In school composition to this day, it is debated, well, what did Earl Warren mean in Brown versus Board of Education? Keep in mind, I don't know how many people could guess how long the opinion was in Brown versus Board of Education. It was less than 10 pages. You think it's this great decision. It is probably the greatest decision of the Supreme Court since Marbury versus Madison. It was 10 pages because Warren knew that if he wrote another sentence, the unanimous consensus he had would start to fall apart. So instead, he got a unanimous opinion. It was short, which meant that the New York Times had to publish the whole thing so that people could read it. They didn't get to say, oh, this is what this means. He knew that. That was what he was trying to accomplish. And there is a price to be paid for it. The price was he didn't resolve all the issues that were going to come forward. You can reasonably debate, should he have issued a 5-4 opinion that's 80 pages long and settled all these issues? And he decided no. He was going to announce the basic principle, let it go, and then it would take generations to try to resolve all the subordinate issues. And they don't even know. To this day, it's debated. Does Brown versus Board of Education prohibit the assignment of students to school on the basis of race? Or does it prohibit the maintenance of schools identifiable on the basis of race? Mm-hmm. It makes a huge difference. If you think the former, then you think affirmative assignment, you assigning white students to a particular school to keep it from becoming too black, as people would say, is impermissible. If you think the latter, that it's supposed to prevent the appearance of segregated schools, then that's exactly what you do to make sure that there aren't all whites at one school and all blacks at others. So yes, the principle carries forward, but the job of interpreting it rests with the courts.
You know, as a university, we offer our faculty tenure, and it's meant to protect intellectual freedom. Now, federal judges as well have lifetime tenure. Why is that important, and what would change if the terms were limited?
Well, I'll give you a concrete example. We had a case, I think it was 4 years ago, involving the Westboro Baptist Church. This is the group that protests at funerals for servicemen who've died, who've been killed in action, in the vilest possible terms. You have a family that just wants to bury the young man or woman who's been killed in action, and they have these protesters out on the sidewalk denigrating their child. And I wrote the opinion for a nearly unanimous court, I think it was 8-1, saying that they had the right to do that. I think what they do is absolutely hateful. And yet, they were on a public sidewalk. The First Amendment protected what they wanted to say. And we issued an opinion saying that. Now, if I didn't have life tenure and had to stand for election the next year, I wouldn't vote for me. I mean, it's the whole point, and the framers understood this, is that judges were not supposed to be popular. They were supposed to issue decisions consistent with the law and the Constitution, and they recognized that those would be unpopular, and they needed life tenure to protect them so that they could do that. That's why I'm always amazed. You get the stories, so the Supreme Court's very unpopular, 45% disapproves. Well, it doesn't matter. If it was 99% disapproved, that wouldn't say we're doing our job. It would probably say that we are doing our job in issuing decisions whether or not they're popular. So life tenure is critically important for what we do.
Well, you mentioned popularity, but in some ways popularity links to understanding. And so where do you think we are in terms of public understanding of the Supreme Court and the ways in which the traditional media and social media present the work of the court? You know, we know where the court typically has come out, but how do you see televising or video recording of Supreme Court proceedings affect the understanding of the court? Do you think it could lead in any instance to greater understanding? Or do you think it's too inhibiting in terms of deliberations?
I think video recording, audio recording, public dissemination would lead to greater understanding of what the court's doing. Our job, however, is not to educate the public. Our job is to decide the cases before us according to the law and the Constitution. That is what we do. And I think as part of the price of doing that effectively, we might have to forego educating people. I think that televising our proceedings would compromise how we do our work. I think it would affect the presentation of the attorneys. I think it would affect the justices on the court. If you've ever been to a Supreme Court argument, and you should go if you can, you will see that it's all very quick. It's all sharp questioning. We don't stop to think, frankly, about the questions. We follow along with the dynamic of the argument, and it leads us to certain areas where you might be posing hypothetical questions. Well, what if this? What if this? What if that? And frankly, if we had to stop just for a moment and think, gosh, how is that going to sound to however many millions of people are watching it? We might end up talking like they do in Congress. You know, it's all, oh, you know, with all due deference to the judgment of my good friend from wherever, and I wonder if this and this. No, we want to, you know, directly try to get to the answer. I think cameras would inhibit that. I think it would affect the presentations of the lawyers. So yes, I think, frankly, when people see us at work, they get a good impression because we do work hard and try to get to the business at hand. But I can't support giving up the dynamic that we have for what would, I think, would be a benefit in greater education.